of what appliances and because of what usage patterns. So this is a state government program where I think by now we are between 200,000 and 300,000 households in Queensland that are going through a government subsidized program to roll out these meters, these energy monitors into their households. So you pay $50, an electrician comes into your house, they do an energy audit, they also install some energy efficient light bulbs, and they also leave you with one of those devices on your kitchen bench. The research, as a point of departure, was interested in how we could take this further. Rather than having a monochrome display that sits on your kitchen bench, we wanted to, first of all, get the data out of there and onto the internet. But then we were interested in other ways to convey the data, rather than to just have this snapshot in time. So the devices we are using right now, they have a internet bridge that allows us to upload data onto PatchBay, and so we have data feeds. And this is what they look like if they are visualized. This is an example of my house. I got two feeds because I have photovoltaic solar panels on my roof, and so the bottom chart displays sun rises in Brisbane, maximum exposure to the sun at 12 noon, maximum production of solar energy, and then the sun goes down again. This was a perfect day with no clouds. If there's clouds, you actually get a bit of a skitter. Then above, you see another clamp that is going around the main power cable that connects my house with the electricity grid. So during the day, as I'm at work, I'm not at home, there's not much electricity being used, the excess electricity is fed back into the grid, and that's again this curve that you see here between 8 and 4 o'clock. Does anyone know what that that jitter is on top, the interference? Yes, that's my fridge. So fridge kicking in, fridge turning off again in order to cool. This one here. Spike? Sorry?
It's a down spike at noon?
I'm not sure if this is because a device was used or if it's just a glitch in the measurement. But this is me making coffee in the morning. This is the hot water booster kicking in. And then the last signature is the dishwasher, going through different cycles of heating and washing. So after a while, you're actually familiarizing yourself with these appliance signatures, and you're able to then start monitoring your usage on this more overview glance, because I'm able to say, okay, this particular thing is the dishwasher, this particular squiggle is the washing machine, that's the doodle that my dryer would make, etc. I can also get a glance view of whether everything is okay, whether everything is still normal and functioning properly. The other type of situation that I asked a lot of the study participants to go through is to identify phantom power. So you try and switch everything off, power points and lights, and even go into the switchboard to turn things off and see if you can get to zero. And I wasn't able to go to zero straight away. It always displayed 350. So I was hunting around, being a detective, to identify where this phantom power of 350 watt came from, until it occurs to me that I have these air conditioning compressors on the roof. In Australia, we don't have much heating, but we have cooling systems. And once I turned off the breaker points for those air conditioning compressors, I was down to zero. And the fact is that these compressors have heating elements that keep them warm, which is a bit ironic for Queensland, where the last thing you want is to keep warm. But when I spoke to the manufacturer, they said it's a standby security device that ensures that if you turn on your air conditioning, it doesn't do a cold start, which I find a bit puzzling. But in winter now, I got them all turned off in order to reduce even more electricity. So 350 watt is actually quite a considerable amount of light. I think we probably use less light right now just lighting up this room. I could probably make it much brighter with 350 watt. So this project is also looking at ways to convey the information different ways. In a way, this is an example of citizen science, but it's still very scientific in a way. We got numeric data, we got wattage, we got different types of units or currency, we got these shards. But there are some people that don't care. They either don't care about the scientific presentation, or they don't care about what's been displayed. So we have some people that said, oh, it's great, I got this device now, and it tells me that I'm using 6 cents of power an hour when I go to work and everything is on standby.
and I don't care about Sixth Sense. So it actually worked counterintuitive or counterproductive. Rather than them actually making sure that they turn everything off, they said, okay, Sixth Sense is fine, I don't care. So we are now looking at ways to create different types of motivation strategies in order to convey this information different ways. But that's the material for another talk. In this example here, I just want to show you the types of sensor data and the types of data we are increasingly producing ourselves and trying to make sense of. This one here is a project that my colleague Eric Paulos has been working on when he was still at Intel. He's now at Carnegie Mellon. But you can still find out more about it at urbanatmospheres.net. It's a picture of Accra in Ghana. And he asked the cab drivers in Accra to attach air quality sensors to the cabs. And so they were measuring, I think in this case it was carbon monoxide, and reporting the location and the time that the measurement was taken, so that Eric was able to create this beautiful map. Although the colors are beautiful, it's actually representing air pollution across the city. So rather than relying on two measurement stations usually, one in the city and one at the airport, you now have a much more fine-grained representation of air pollution across a region or a city in this case. And you can see the kinds of nuances. So the dark colors, sorry?
Sorry, I was asking if the red lines indicating there's like lots of pollution along the streets.
Yes, and I believe the dark purple, I would have to go back into the legend to see the colors, but as from memory, the dark colors are bad and the lighter colors are good. The other point that this picture illustrates is the fact that the citizen science approach can work in these interesting ways. So the cab driver started to read their own readings and started to make sense of them themselves. So they started to reroute their usual way to go from A to B in order to avoid the polluted areas, in turn changing the picture, yeah, because they are themselves contributing to the pollution. So this is one of the other examples of a citizen science approach. And MIT, the Sensible City Lab that Carlo Ratti is heading, they are currently working with the Singaporean government on a number of real-time data approaches as well. This one here that is taken from the Live Singapore website, that's what the project is called, displays the Formula One racetrack in Singapore. And you can see on the right a picture that illustrates the mobile phone traffic as Fernando Alonso wins the Formula One. So lots of traffic of people emailing, texting, taking photos, and sending them across across the racetrack. This one here shows the mobile phone traffic across different cells of the network. The penetration of mobile phones is above 140%, they say. So on average, people have more than one mobile device that connects to the network. And this is the distribution of where they are connecting most often in order to identify densities. This one here is interesting as well. It shows rain clouds over Singapore and the distribution of cabs in the city. A lot of the public transport system is based on cab drivers. And so you can see where are people wanting cabs and where are the cabs right now in order to have a correlation between need and demand and supply. So to wrap up this part of the talk, there is government data, and increasingly a lot of the officials are interested and are willing to make government data available, but the challenges are still about access and the type of protocols available. Social media data, that the type of data that contributes to the social cultural context and helps us visualize those types of nuances in our urban experience, and sensor network data. Each one on their own already quite interesting, but what we are really interested in is a mashup that allows us to combine all three and maybe even other categories of data. So this is a framework that allows us to have an integrated open data API. It's like a meta API that we've been proposing for Queensland cities and regional centers, but at the same time it would work elsewhere in a similar fashion. So you have those different categories of data available. They live down here. The substrate is not a large repository. It's not to copy and paste and keep archival records. The substrate is much more like a switchboard. So if I, for instance, have a scenario where I say, I want to leave from Harvard Square, I want to go to Emerson College, I want to leave in the next half hour, I can go onto a journey planner, and most of the journey planners are either optimized for distance or for speed. I want to, for instance, have a journey planner that says, or that allows me to search for the scenic way. I want to go from Harvard to the city the least polluted way. And I had a bad day because Colin pissed me off, and so, you know, I don't want to be exposed to anyone that I'm friends with on Facebook. Okay? So there is a, you know, example, and this is just something that, you know, I made up, where I'm integrating government data.
You did make it up.
Where, or I could, you know, modify and say, where's Colin right now? I want to have a meeting with him on the bus or on the train. But yeah, this is an example where you have public government data, in this case, transport data. The sensor network data would give me the air pollution levels, and you have social media data about the location of the friends that have agreed to share their whereabouts with me. Right now, it's not quite easy to do that, but I'd like to achieve a level of ease that is similar to programming an iPhone. Now, that might be still complicated for a number of people. But say on an iPhone, I can go and say, iPhone, give me my location. And as a programmer, I expect to get, as a return, longitude, latitude, and accuracy. And I don't have to worry about the underlying complexity of how the phone does that. What kind of GPS chip is embedded? Does it use GPS, assisted GPS, mobile tower triangulation? I don't care. As a programmer, I have this integrated development environment where that data comes back. And so that's the kind of level of ease that I'd like Boston to achieve, or Brisbane to achieve, or London to achieve, that I can actually say, Brisbane, I want this and this and this, and the underlying complexities of ownership, protocol, accuracy, etc., is being taken care of. So the substrate is like the switchboard. The development framework is really where the programming occurs. What we call significant situations is a theoretical concept that allows us to make sense of all the data that surrounds us. Otherwise, it's just too overwhelming. So we're looking at this idea of, which is derived from context research, to pick those types of data sets that are relevant right now, and they become, they go into the foreground. There's a different interface, there's different interface layers, and an application layer on top of which the applications run, such as this interesting kind of journey planner. So that's the overall architecture for the framework, but and a lot of the, you know, the geeks and the techies, they say, well, you know, technology is not the problem. This can be done from a technical point of view. The real challenge are the legal, the social, the cultural types of questions, and so that's really what the talk is trying to stimulate.
Are you assuming that this is something that government should implement, or is could you see the private sector doing it, and have you
both.
An angle on how to...
At the moment, in the Australian context, we've been going around talking to both private and public entities, and it's different stories I need to tell in order to get the attention from different people. So an SAP or a Cisco, an IBM, they might be interested in different aspects of this scenario than, say, the Department of Health, the Department of Housing, the Premier's Department. So, but I think there's something in there for both the private and the public sector. But more so, I think a lot of the attention around real-time data is to benefit the ones that, you know, are usually displayed at the top. The architects that are planning buildings, the urban planners that are planning cities, government officials that are in charge of cities. I'd like to be able to take the power of the data that they increasingly already have access to and make it available to ordinary people. I want, you know, this kind of data in my phone in order to make similar types of decision-making, to create similar kinds of decision-making support systems than the top 100 already have access to in a number of cases. So similarly, how we have, you know, going from Web 1.0 to 2.0, how we have in the old days professionally trained GIS experts that were only able to access maps and sophisticated kind of mapping systems. Now we have Google Maps and Google Earth. This whole idea of neo-geography, where we can all take advantage of these types of things. I think there's this kind of trend for a neo-data kind of movement, where the data is not only accumulated and made available, and there's APIs and so forth, for the experts, for the programmers, for the decision makers, but for everyone as well. And so this is the idea of that interface layer that is trying to unleash the creative potential. Similarly, how Apple and I don't have shares in Apple anymore. But similarly how, so I could just say, you know, Google or any other company, but similarly how the ecosystem that they created allows all these other third parties, programmers, to create applications for Android, for iOS, and so forth, taking advantage of the features of the phone, the microphone, the accelerometer, the GPS, the screen, and so forth. The city has also all these types of assets in a different fashion, and I'd like to be able to play with them. So that's really the vision for this scenario. I took this shot from a guy that just graduated with a master's, research master's from the OII, Tim Davies, and I found this quite useful because we got data and, you know, all these kinds of data sets on the left side, but then there's different types of correlations and interrogations and queries we can run. So one is to derive facts. I can go into census data and there are certain facts that you can look at. There's information, which might be up to interpretation, and you might be able to create reports that display that. There's different types of interfaces, and so this is already where we're getting closer to the way that information is displayed. I'm talking about visualizations, dynamic visualizations. Then we got data to data, which is primarily the bottom half of what I'm talking about. The substrate is providing these pipes through APIs in order to mesh up data. And so it's, you know, between different categories of data. And then on the highest level, and ironically it's the bottom level here, it's the data to service kind of correlation, where you're actually able to create new experiences. So I might be running a conference, and I want to have a journey planner that is specifically tailored to the needs of my delegates. It only takes into consideration where the recommended hotels are. It takes into consideration when the conference dinner will be. It might take them the scenic way, so they're not stuck in traffic. So all those types of mashups that could be tailored for certain experiences. This is an example of a site that now exists in Australia called OSGOL, the Australian Government's Open Access and Licensing Framework. So specifically within the government context, more and more people are realizing, well, Government 2.0 is not just stopping here by publishing data on the internet. We have to look at licensing issues about protocols, about ownership, about accuracy and authenticity and so forth. And this is a approach where they're actually looking at the Creative Commons licensing framework in order to try and translate it specifically for the purpose of government data. So those are the kinds of, you know, big questions that are actually in the way, not so much the technical questions, but other types of questions about licensing. Who owns the data, who's responsible for it, how can it be used in various ways? If I make money using that data, do I have to provide a return to the originator and so forth? Accuracy and trust, which is a concern for a number of people when it comes to big decisions. So if I use social media data to decide where I want to grab a coffee, and, you know, people say that this Starbucks sucks and this Starbucks is much better, well, you know, it's just the coffee. But if it's about buying a house and I'm looking at crime data or flood searches, how high was the Brisbane River in January, well, that's far more important to me and far more significant. I want to make sure that it's accurate and I can trust it. How do I verify that it can be trusted? Is there metadata attached to it that tells me that these are the people responsible and these are the people I can sue if my house does get flooded? Ownership, I already mentioned. Protocols and metadata, the actual implementation of metadata that describes the state that the data is in addition to the data stream itself. Obviously, privacy and confidentiality, if you combine so many different constellations, are you actually able to triangulate, you know, people's location, people's whereabouts, and obviously a lot of people are, rightly so, concerned about this. There's also a trend for these mashups and hackfests to pop up in this serendipitous way where governments make data sets available, especially sponsored by those repositories. We also had the state libraries of all the different states in Australia create a library hackfest where people were accessing or able to access their data in order to see what's the creative potential of what can we do with this kind of data. Actually, we don't have all those answers yet. And the big question is also, you know, does the transparency that this is inducing, does that lead to more democracy? I promised to put in a little plug for the book that I've been editing with Laura Folano, who is another OII colleague. She's now in Chicago. Christine Satchel in our lab and Martin Gibbs in Melbourne. It's called From Social Butterfly to Engaged Citizen. And do we know when it's going to be released? I'm looking at the colleague from MIT Press. I was told on the 25th, so it should be out next week. And I'm very pleased that this is finally coming to fruition. It's a number of chapters. Judith has contributed the afterword, and I'm very grateful for that. It's trying to really have the one compendium that you can thrust onto the table, because it's like over 500 pages, so it's quite a weapon. If anyone really says, you know, oh, social media, that's really all ridiculous, and my kids play with it, and it has no impact, well, there is 500 pages of evidence that it does have an impact. So this goes from Usha Hidi, from citizen journalism, from civic engagement, to creative engagements, to storytelling, to environmental sustainability, to a whole range of different accounts that we've accumulated in order to provide evidence that social media these days is also used to do all these other things, not just to organize social gatherings to drink a soy latte. And that's something that I feel is quite important. I hope that other people will build on top of this work. I'm also pleased Carlos is waiting outside. His student was actually responsible for the cover design. So this talk I'm giving at RPI this afternoon, Carlos was so kind to get one of his students to design a flyer, and I like the flyer so much, and MIT Press as well, that they decided to use the design, the artwork, as the actual cover for the book. So that graphic there with the butterfly has been created by Matt Rolfe at RPI. And this is what the book is about. So urban informatics, social media, UBCOM, mobile tech to support citizen engagement. It's based on the Digital Cities workshop that we ran at the Communities and Technologies Conference at Penn State, and another workshop we ran in Australia, and we also had invited contributions from a number of people, and I encourage you to check it out when it is available. It says December here, but it should be ready pretty soon. So that's all I had for today. There's those, you know, big questions, and as I said in the beginning, I don't have all the answers, but I wanted to see if we could, you know, start a conversation about these things, because the fourth bubble, the fourth kind of circle in our Venn diagram, is the kind of legal governance policy dimension, and that's still a little bit underrepresented. But then again, I'm happy to, you know, rely on the Berkman Center and the affiliated fellows and colleagues to help us out in order to look into these types of questions. So thanks so much for your attention.
So this is a wonderful talk, and a lot of these topics are really close to the parts of the work that we're doing over at the Center for Civic Media as well. I went to high school with Roberto Lano, actually.
Oh, there we go. Well, tell her.
But what I'm interested in is to hear you talk a little bit more about a few slides back. You had sort of potential challenges.
This
is this one, yeah. So I'd love to see you add an inclusion bubble here and talk a little bit more about the, you know, vastly differential access to ICTs and what that means if your larger question is around, you know, democracy and participation in democratic processes, and the fact that we have such radically unequal access to the tools and skills of digital media production, which includes sort of production of these large data sets that you'll draw from to make policy decisions and run your apps and all that kind of stuff. We have a real problem. So how can that question be, I guess, sort of, you know, integrated into the framework? Because really it's at the heart of your final question around
The purpose of this slide was really to pop up a number of questions to stir the debate. It's not actually to say that our research is trying to answer them all. That would be overkill. I do think, though, that they're important, and it does require a larger concerted effort in order to tackle these big questions. With regards to access and the digital divide and, you know, how does this pan out, there's probably not just one single answer, but a number of answers. So one of them, as to just illustrate, during the Queensland floods that happened in January, social media was used in quite interesting ways, and a number of people later on said, oh, but this is only for, you know, the top X percent that are on smartphones, that have an iPad, that use computers, that are on the internet. But what we found actually from the research that we've done so far is that there is a bit of a water cooler effect. So those that are connected in those situations at least, I don't know if this is transferable to, you know, any situation, but in those extreme situations, there's a lot of communication that occurs face-to-face that wouldn't necessarily occur otherwise. So people are actually talking in the hallway, they're talking to their neighbors, they make sure that, do you know that we are supposed to be evacuated? Do you have, you know, enough supplies? Do you know the power is going to be cut off for X number of hours longer? So some of the information that comes through social media is then distributed in other ways. So it's not that we are talking about an either-or, social media or nothing, or social media or old media, that it's much more a communicative ecology where certain information comes in one channel and gets distributed via other channels as well, including face-to-face and old media and traditional mass media. So we did have examples where the official authorities were jumping onto social media to also distribute and broadcast information. In fact, they were also trying to counteract the tendency of myths being created. So people saying, oh, there's going to be cholera virus or bacteria in the water. There's going to be, you know, they were claiming that there's a higher number of death tolls than what actually occurred. So the Twitter account of the Queensland Police was pushing these mythbusters out in order to provide a more accurate and authentic source of information. Now, another answer to your question is about what do we mean by access? Is it, you know, just smartphones? Is that the kind of, you know, prime goal that we, the kind of challenge that we set ourselves? Or is there other ways of looking at data, looking at communication, looking at this world? And I think Ethan and the work that you do in the center and so forth, I'm preaching to the converted when I say that there's lots of mobile phones, not the most sophisticated ones, but mobile phones in general, that make a huge difference in developing countries, in you know, South Africa and other places where, you know, I don't have a home, I don't have a permanent address, but I have a bank account and it operates in my Nokia. And it's just the monochrome display, but, you know, there's money on it and I can use it to pay. And so there is ways to use technology in less technically sophisticated ways, but they're still sophisticated in, you know, in other aspects. And so that's, you know, another potential answer to your question about how do we look at these types of developments. So I do think it's definitely, you know, important that that dimension is represented here, and I should add this in a new version of the talk. But I don't actually have, you know, definite answers yet to that either.
But I think it would be also really important to the last point that you made, that typically state agencies are setting up these types of systems and opening APIs, but often are completely ignoring the information that could become coming into the system from the cheaper phones, phones, that kind of thing. So it's incredibly important to not only focus these tools on the smartphones side of things.
Yeah, I agree. And it would actually be great to have some demonstrators to actually go into a discussion with government officials and say, well, this is what you can do with a smartphone, but here is also what you could do in other types of means to just demonstrate the potential.
Do you have any concerns about how people might use this open data in ways that are not necessarily socially desirable? For instance, I can imagine somebody who wants to work just knowing where there's very little traffic, very little electricity during the day.
Yes, and I think there is even already some sites that say there's Fear Square, which is about crime data. There's, I think, a number of applications that make the data available of where sentenced pedophiles live across different countries, and you can access that data and, you know, what you do with that. You know, there's obviously options that we've seen. There's also a site that is robmyhouse.com, I think, or, you know, steal my items. Sorry, what is it called? Please Rob Me. Yeah, I think that's
right,
the one.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Somewhat related to what I asked, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kinds of, you know, that's the downside, I suppose. But with any kind of technical innovation, there's, you know, the technology itself is pretty much neutral. It's about the usage of the technology that is then going the one or the other way. And it's about the deployment, the policies, the practical kinds of frameworks that surround the technology that determines how it pans out. But again, I wouldn't want this type of thing to stop just because people are too concerned about the negative consequences. It's probably important to be aware of them and see what we can do about them. But again, I don't have all the answers in order to say, well, this is exactly how we're going to prevent all these bad things from happening. I think all the benefits that happen towards the social good there's obviously lots of them that could also happen towards the social, you know, bad and negative kinds of consequences. We just have to have, you know, a good balance. Yeah, exactly.
I remember going to a lot of discussions about electronic record keeping way back in the day, and there were a lot of competing interests of preventing that from happening, such as lawyers who didn't want that whole genre to take place. Of course, you know, and it's still a problem in that arena. Do you see competing interests not wanting this to be deployed or to, you know, that framework to be built and that open API to be developed?
Yes, I do think that in each of those, you know, different areas, that there's probably people that are gatekeepers, and they actually, you know, have set themselves up in a quite cushy way, that this is kind of counterproductive, counter to their interests, with regards to liability issues, with regards to privacy, information might leak. Transparency probably has that dimension as well. If we look at WikiLeaks, the idea that lots of data that is been confidential in certain ways is being made available now for people to interrogate on their own account, but it has other consequences that we can't really foresee in certain ways. So yes, definitely. And again, I would hope that eventually we are able to create enough examples and demonstrators and points of reference where we can say, well, here is what's happening in a good way, and here is where we learn our lesson from where it went wrong, in order to move forward, rather than the whole development to be stopped.
I was just going to comment on the opportunity for innovation, and you know, as a result of philosophy and maybe groups like, you know, the MIT Enterprise Center, different groups that have SIGs and are following data, and also connecting with entrepreneurs might also be a great place to kind of.
Oh yes, definitely. You know, yeah. I think at the moment our focus and our interactions have been with government, and specifically local government, because of the previous interests and current interests of the research lab. But a colleague of mine in information systems, he does a lot of business process management and business process management optimization, where he has these very intricate flow charts of how a business goes about their business, their operations, and then he's able to say, well, if you do this differently, you are able to produce, you know, X more cans of Coke at this best price. So he's interested in those types of commercial, you know, implications, but he's also now interested increasingly in this data phenomenon, and he said that, for instance, Qantas Airlines, Australia's largest airline, has been hiring 3 Twitter professionals, and all they do all day is search the Twitter network for anyone that is mentioning air travel. Like, I want to fly to London. And if they find them, they're going to respond. They send a direct message or a reply and say, oh, do you know that Qantas has a special right now to go to London for $900 and we can take care of you? And so he says that rather than having these manual kind of mechanical Turk approach, that you actually have a more automated one where the business, the service, the experience comes to you. Rather than you coming to the store, to the website, or you need to do something, you just say on Twitter, I want to go to Boston next week. And then the next morning, Air New Zealand, Singapore Airlines, and Qantas have ready-made packages for you. They follow it through. They use the experience in order to provide baggage tagging, insurance, where is your hotel, so the whole lot. So this is kind of, you know, where we are now. This is the vision that he's been postulating and talking to companies about. But that's the kind of stuff that they're really interested in with regards to social media and big data sets.
And also to see new business opportunities. Yeah. If you're an entrepreneur, to see, yeah, there's an opportunity for, yeah, new products. Yeah, new
when we spoke to the our great department of...
I think you'd want to be able to affirmatively opt into that if you want to, and
yeah,
have it happen
of
to
course,
you.
Of course, of course. Like so often in these cases. When we spoke to our Department of State Development, they looked at this with a kind of puzzled eye because they couldn't straight away see what's the benefit for their mission and their objectives. And we said, well, how about having a, you know, they're interested in how the economy is doing in Queensland. They are interested in investing, companies investing, coming from overseas, putting up branches and new factories and so forth. So they are looking at economic indicators, and they get really, you know, they fetishize these economic indicators. And I said, well, what about a coffee indicator that tells you of how many business meetings are occurring right now in different Starbucks coffee places And this talk is not sponsored by Starbucks, but because I see them so often, it just kind of comes to my head. So to kind of say, you know, there's an indicator that you've been using for a while and they're all looking normal, but say your coffee indicator all of a sudden is going down. So what's going on? So you might want to, you know, ask yourself, what's going on right now? Why are people not having as many business meetings right now? Now, obviously, there's questions technically in regards to the social dimensions of how we arrive at that data. But just in terms of the implications it might have for their radar, for their dashboard. So all of a sudden, we had, you know, them quite interested in arguing and considering the types of possibilities that big data sets provide for them as well.
Well, I guess an application, how to become an Australian citizen, would certainly be one that would catch a lot of attention. But my question is
sorry, why is that?
Well, how to become an Australian citizen would certainly be an application that would be used, that, you know, the Australian government could put out, and that would be accepted with relish from the worldwide audience. No, my question is there, or have you come across a sort of more systematic method for creativity, finding applications, than organizing hackfests?
Well, I think hackfests are the most prominent kind of example in that space. But again, this is just a different variation of a hackfest. We've been proposing certain data sets to our students, and they've been creating applications or proposals as part of their coursework, as part of their assignments.
That's one of the big problems the European Union is facing now. Offering all this data, but nobody's writing an application.
Yeah. So, well, I had the discussion yesterday with Eric Gordon, and we both agreed that that's a huge problem, really, because of the technical nature of these data sets, or sometimes the scientific nature of these data sets, the lay user is not necessarily interested, and so we do have to have, well, there's two options. Either we have to have the kind of dialogue, and it might be that ethnography or design methods or qualitative research provides that interface between the ones that know about living in Boston, living in the city, being lay users and residents, and the ones that have the technical expertise of being able to interrogate the data, being able to create those mashup applications and so forth, so that it's not this kind of serendipitous thing of a couple of pointy heads going and looking at data and saying, oh, I'm going to create an application that does X, Y, and Z, and it's really geeky and cool, and you know, it wins a prize, but then it just sits on a website or it sits in the App Store and no one is really using it. So what are the pragmatic types of applications? The other option, and that's the one that we're trying to push, is to get rid of the middleman. Not necessarily completely, but you know, in a way there's food production, food consumption, and there's the middleman that, you know, keeps them separate so that it works. So here, the middlemen are the ones that have the ability to translate data and the technicalities into applications and decision-making support tools. If we have a framework that makes the programming part so easy that it's not really programming anymore, it's really just, you know, putting different elements together to curate your own decision support system, then the people that are at the receiving end right now become much more active agents in that process. And so the translation that usually occurs through ethnography and design methods, it could actually be shrunk down or even made redundant by them being able to just, you know, self-serve.
Okay, my comment on that is it's the middleman who really controls things. Google determines where you go to find things, and there are other search engines. Monetizing this is a very big thing on the internet, and controlling that seems to be a very big issue. I mean, there are a lot of companies, TripAdvisor, Gobee, lots of different companies in the travel industry directing people, or all the airline fare search engines, and bypassing that kind of locks you into, for example, a particular airline, so that it's hard for an ordinary user to just bypass it without a lot of additional information about what is the most reliable site for a particular application. And there's also another scary side to this, that it's not just companies like Google who control these, but governments like China or Iran who are very interested in data mining, your Twitter feeds and things like that.
Yeah.
very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Yeah.
So, my remark is related. How do you see the development of this project in the medium run? So, if you really want to unleash the potential for innovation that comes from this, which is, I think, huge, you really have to let it free and get rid of the middleman, as you say, because the basic idea of innovation is that you don't know what will pop up. You don't have to control how people access the data so that they make actually a productive use of it, which we see with Wikipedia. People are making LaTeX courses with Wikipedia because it's built in LaTeX. Then they use it for sightseeing. You can see all the monuments around you and stuff. But if you do that, all the privacy issues arise right away. So what is the usage that people make of this data? So you have a trade-off here, and how do you evaluate that? You may have to, as you said, build a partnership with lawyers and stuff. In the media room, how do you see this balance?
The way that we've framed it so far in our pitches and funding proposals is to have a tiered, a staged approach of release. So rather than going, we want to conquer the world straight away. Well, yes, world innovation has been my goal since 2004 when I was at the OII. But what we first want to do has have a limited scope. In this case, we have identified a specific entity, the state library, a specific building, a specific ecology of people, of data, and so forth, where we can trial these things. So that's our sandbox. Then we want to go one notch up and look at, say, a city on a wider regional kind of scope, but also, again, limited by the types of data sources that we are including. So rather than looking at everything, we propose three demonstrators, one in public transport, one in health, and one in emergency response management. And so at that stage, we were proposing to look after the implementation of those three demonstrators, but the goal would be, as you said, to increasingly make ourselves redundant and say, well, this is, you know, what you can do on the application layer. Go out and come up with ideas. And so it might be that it's a hack fest. It might be that it's an open challenge. It might be that it's tenders where both private or public representatives would put in money in order to create customized applications and take advantage of the infrastructure. But we want to grow it in an organic fashion, rather than to have, you know, world domination straight away. And that's just a joke about world domination. But you kind of get the gist that we completely agree with you that this doesn't easily happen overnight. But I think that different pieces of the puzzle are now popping up. And it's more a matter of putting them together in a strategic way in order to eventually arrive at the bigger picture. And so that's what we are hoping to contribute towards.
I think on that note, is it quick or is it going to be a quick comment, and then I think we should thank Mark.
The whole sort of data repository notion was sort of a, if we build it, they will come. And the trouble is, not all data is interesting. And it also forgets the basic, you know, notion about how you build applications. You ask the customer what they want, and then you build it, rather than, you know, slam a ton of data against the wall and hope somebody can pick out, you know, something interesting, where there's something actually relevant.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the local transit authority here, you know, has real-time bus data. So there have been dozens of applications written to find out when the next bus will pass on Mass Ave.
Yeah.
That works because it's relevant.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, that should really be the first step, rather than at the way that it happens at the moment. I think that was a similar comment here, that we are going step two and then go step one. It should really be that we look at what are the kinds of needs, what are the kinds of, you know, everyday practices out there in the city, and they are different for different people, and then look at, well, how can we respond to those needs. So, yeah, I completely agree. Thank you so much. It has been great, and thank you for my feedback.